For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host, Red Sale, and coming up this week, Lauren Wolk explores teenage resilience and alternative remedies in her Carnegie Medal shortlisted novel, Echo Mountain. Connect Radio's Ellie Marsh learns more about an exciting online book group with author Fiona Shaw. Sarah Milano discusses her compelling new novel, This Can Never Not Be True, with Robert Kirkwood. And loyal listener N.B. Dixon reviews a spine-tingling tale by Sarah Waters. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Lauren Wolk is an award-winning author, poet, and visual artist. Both of her first two novels, Wolf Hollow and Beyond the Bright Sea, have been shortlisted for the Philip Carnegie Medal in past years, and now her third, Echo Mountain, has followed suit. It's a haunting tale set in the wilderness during the Great Depression of the 1930s. And Lauren joined me from her home in Cape Cod to tell me all about it. Lauren, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you so much, Red.
For those who haven't yet picked up this brilliant audiobook that I've been enjoying all weekend, could you please take us into the world of Echo Mountain?
Sure. I wish I could take you all to the mountains of Maine, which inspired the book. If you feel like coming across the pond, I'd love to take you there. It's a very wild and beautiful place where I go camping, or I suppose I should say glamping, because we don't have tents. We have a little cabin, but it's still fairly wild there. There's no running water. There's no electricity. It's very primitive and wild, which is the way I like it. And spending time on that mountain over the years really inspired the book. But because I write historical fiction, as much as being there was the main research that I did, you know, because the woods and the rivers and the mountains really haven't changed over the last 100 years, at least not in that part of the world, I had to do research to find out what it was like for people living in Maine during the Great Depression. I grew up, my parents were Depression babies, and my mother from farm people. The life there didn't really change very much over the years. So when I went to visit the family farm, I was immersed in the past in a lot of ways. But I still had to read some books, and I had to learn a lot about the kind of medical practices they had in those days, because my main character, Ellie, is a budding healer. And she learns from a woman named Kate, who is known as the Hag, who is also a healer. And they had to use what they could find in the wilderness to heal themselves and each other. So I had to learn a lot about that. But the world of Echo Mountain is really a mountain world. It's a wild world. It's a place where people who've lived there for generations coexist with people who've had to move into the wilderness because they've lost their homes. So it's really a coming of age story. And it's really about courage and self-reliance and resourcefulness and selflessness and finding our best selves.
And Ellie and her family have had to leave the town where they had a comfortable existence and make a new life on the side of this mountain, which to her mother and Ellie's elder sister feels very alien, very threatening. And to Ellie and her father, well, they embrace it. They don't try and tame it like the mother and Esther. They embrace it and try and live in nature and with nature.
They do. They do. And that's a huge difference, because, you know, adapting to the situation you're in can be very difficult, but it's really essential for happiness without sacrificing who you really are. The inner Ellie stays the same. In fact, it comes out even more. Being in the wilderness brings out her inner wildness and her appreciation for nature and all those things I was speaking of before, like bravery and resourcefulness. She has to learn a lot, but she taps an inner resource that her sister and her mother either lack or have just suppressed. You know, civilization kind of tries to beat that out of us, that connection with nature. And in Ellie's case and her father's case, and to a large extent, her little brother Samuel's case, nature speaks to them and they answer with full hearts and full throats. And so they have a very fine relationship with the wild world, and it means they can be happy there.
And Ellie genuinely feels that echo of nature within herself when she has to go and gather honey to act as an antiseptic. She feels the fear of the bees who are leaving what will sustained their life in the winter. And she understands why they sting her. She doesn't have the typical townie's reaction to a swarm of bees doing only what is natural to them.
Exactly. She is very empathetic. Empathy is so important. I believe that's true in every aspect of life. And she is naturally that way, but nature brings it out even more in her. She feels for those bees. She understands they're doing exactly what you said, what they are meant to do, and that stinging her makes them die. So they're certainly not going to do that unless they're trying to protect the hive, the queen, everything, their whole life. And so, yeah, the bees are very important in this book, and they're very important in our world. I hope people who read this book already know, or if they don't, quickly discover that without bees, we're all lost. They're our friends. But even if they weren't, whether it's an animal we perceive as a threat or not, the natural world is always trying to achieve balance, and we could learn some lessons from that.
And the natural world is also full of things that can help us and act as remedies to us, such as honey and balsam. And that's really brought home because Ellie and her family are so far away from doctor's help that if they don't act immediately, they could die.
Exactly. And that's the way it is in many parts of the world even now, but it was certainly true then. And during the Depression, yes, these people who had always lived in towns and relied on doctors and nurses and what they perceived then as modern medicine suddenly had to rely on themselves. And the mother and the older sister, Esther, reject that notion. They don't exactly give up in the face of adversity, but they certainly don't look to themselves for the solution, whereas Ellie does. And I think if more of us did and, you know, tapped into our own intelligence and empathy and our inner resources, we would be far more self-reliant. I do believe in modern medicine. We're going through a terrible experience right now, all of us, where modern medicine is a huge solution to a problem. But I also believe that we need to look to nature and ourselves for a lot of the answers to our problems.
At the beginning of the book, Ellie's father has been put into a coma by an accident. And because of an incident that happens very early on in the book, Ellie is convinced that maybe a sharper stimulus might be needed to take him out of his coma. And we as readers have really to ask ourselves, has she gone completely wild? And do we side with her mother, who is obviously rather concerned at some of the remedies that Ellie is exploring?
Well, this is a very good question, because I think it's true of a lot of books about young people, people coming of age, certainly my books about these girls coming of age, that they're testing themselves and the world, and they're going to make mistakes in the process. They have the best of intentions. They're smart. They're brave. They're inventive. They're imaginative. They're empathetic. They're all these good things, but they're still young. And actually, there are a lot of adults who, when they strike out into new territory, make mistakes as well. Those mistakes, you might call them failures, but they are the way we learn. But along the way, people can get hurt and do get hurt. And it's just a consequence, I suppose, of trying new things. In Ellie's case, she has watched lullabies, as I call them in the book, these gentle approaches to healing the father figure, fail over and over again. So she decides something more radical is needed. And she listens to the natural world, and the natural world says back to her, try us, try the stink of a skunk, although she never gets that far, try the sting of a bee, and other things I won't reveal in case listeners haven't yet gotten that far. But she is determined to trust herself and what she has at her disposal, which is things like bees and snakes. But you're right, the mother and Esther and the civilized world would frown on these, and do frown on these attempts, because they are so wild. And wildness is frightening for some people. For me, it's invigorating. It's reassuring, actually. And so I think it is too for Ellie.
And you also show that a certain yuck factor is just part of everyday life.
The yuck factor, the ick factor. Yes, maggots, ew. I agree, maggots are unsavory, and I can't imagine somebody piling them on a wound of mine. And yet, modern medicine has returned to some of these old remedies like maggots and leeches, because there is virtue and merit in them. And so, yeah, they're icky, but so is losing your leg. So is having a terrible infection in a wound. And so it's kind of like fighting fire with fire. Kate gets her wound from a fisher cat, which is a very, very vicious animal when threatened, and attacks Kate and leaves a terrible infection in her leg. And so, you know, there's wildness that causes it, and wildness turns out to be her remedy for it. And Ellie picks up on that cue as well and becomes a little hag.
I'm glad we've come on to discuss the hag. Kate, the hag of the story, well, that's the way that the suspicious ex-townies refer to her, because she is different, because she looks rather unsavory. And yet Ellie learns not to judge the book by its cover, that actually everybody has a backstory if you are prepared to investigate it.
Exactly. You know, the word hag is interesting. It's equated in the book and in life often with the word witch. And witch, of course, has all kinds of history to it. But really, there's a great deal of virtue, merit, and pride, or there ought to be, in being a hag, because a hag is a wise woman, somebody who has learned a lot in her life, regardless of her age, but especially in older women, who have a lot to impart to us and who have contributed a great deal to our society. So I think Kate welcomes that word in a way, and yet because it is used by the ex-townspeople in a derogatory way, of course it hurts as well. But Ellie sees beyond all that because of her empathetic nature. As you say, she does not judge books by their cover. She sees past all that, as I think she hopes other people would see her for more than what she looks like. We would all do well to practice that. And so there's this almost immediate relationship between the two of them that is based on respect, really, appreciation for who they really are beneath the skin.
Yes, and a certain degree of blunt speaking, which again is turning your back maybe on those urban civilized ways where people don't always speak their minds, and you can have an equal amount of misunderstanding because of that.
Indeed, I would far rather have someone speak the truth to my face than say what they think I want to hear, or what is socially acceptable, what is polite, and then say something else behind my back, or even just think something else behind my back. I think there's always, always a place for kindness and civility. But we can be honest with one another, depending on the situation, of course. I think we need to remember that our opinion is just our opinion, no more or less valid than anyone else's. And so Hag, yes, she is a straight shooter. She's a very brusque, opinionated woman, and she speaks her truth. Ellie is a little more reticent than that. She's only 12 years old, so she has yet to learn some things that Kate has under her belt. But the two of them do have that appreciation for honesty in common, despite the fact that Ellie hides quite a bit and has some secrets, mostly for the sake of other people in an effort not to hurt them. But she's learning. She's learning about the importance of all kinds of honesty in her life.
And at the core of this book is a consideration of the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we tell other people, either so that they might see us in a better light or others might be seen in a better light.
Yes, we have a lot of myths. We have the stories we tell ourselves. And then my father, my dear departed father, used to say, it's one thing to try and fool someone else. It's an entirely different and much more dangerous practice to fool yourself. And so being honest with yourself, I think, is the most important thing. And I think it's at the root of personal happiness. If we can be honest with ourselves and true to who we are, we have a better chance of being happy and productive and have good relationships with others. But you're right, there is a dichotomy. We tell ourselves some stories and we tell other people other stories. You know, people say no man is an island, no woman is an island, and that's true. We are all connected to one another. But really, I do believe we are all islands. We are alone in this world in a very real sense, and we have to be happy on that island alone. We have to be honest, and we have to be aware and perceptive and observant and brave enough to face the truth about ourselves if we can perceive it honestly. So yeah, I think we're both connected to every other living being on this planet, human or not, and we're entirely alone at the same time. And I think Ellie feels that.
There is also another mystery going on in the background. Who is leaving the beautiful carvings of small creatures and flowers for Ellie? And what do they mean? That too is an exploration of loneliness and friendship.
It is. And it's also manages to creep its way into all my books. It's a statement about the power of art as a language, as a connection, as a bridge between us. So you have these lonely people, turns out, well, we won't talk about who's leaving the carvings, but somebody who is, and Ellie who receives them. And they are therefore this silent language between them. Even if she never meets the person leaving them for her, they represent to her a connection that she has been sorely missing and lacking in her life. She's reassured that someone actually knows she's there and believes she is worth these gifts. And so it's incredibly important. I think art, well, I'm an artist myself as a writer and a visual artist, and I work with hundreds of artists in my job. And I do not believe that we as a species could really get along without art, without the arts, without that connection between us. It's a universal language. We all speak. We're all able to interpret art in our own ways. And so I think the more we do to encourage reading, writing, and every kind of art, the healthier we will all be.
And your book has, of course, been made even more accessible by being recorded as an audiobook very beautifully by Holly Linneman. Did you have anything to do with selecting her as a narrator?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. It's an interesting story, but each time one of my books has been recorded, I've been sent some samples of people they are considering for the job. And I have to be honest that I always hear in the voices too much of the modern world. And I therefore go looking for someone who sounds to me a little more old-fashioned, a little less millennial, I suppose I could say. And so I sit, usually I'm in a hotel room somewhere, and I just listen to one sample after the next till I hear that voice that sounds to me like Ellie or Annabelle or Crow. And in each case, they have gone with the voice that I chose, which is really makes me very, very happy. There's nothing wrong with any of the voices they have sent me, but an old-fashioned voice suits historical fiction best, I think. So Holly does a great job.
One of them had a white forepaw. Another was bigger than the rest. Another, some color in his coat. And my boy had some brindle, too, and a white tip to his tail, as if it were a brush he'd dipped in paint. So that set him apart. But I didn't need a marker. I was sure that I would know him again in an instant. And I was sure that he would know me. "I'll have to think of a name for you," I told him, as he began to gulp down his new life. And I did just that all through my morning chores. While I pulled winter grass from the potato patch, I decided against Shadow, though he was dark and it suited him. I thought of Possum, because he hadn't really been dead, not really, as I bundled the grass and set it aside for the cows. I considered Boy, which he was, and Beauty, which he also was, as I weeded early spinach come up from autumn seed. I thought about Tipper, for that white tip, as I bundled kindling. And finally, while I stowed the wood in the bin by the big kitchen stove, chose Quiet.
Holly Linneman, narrating Echo Mountain, written by my guest, Lauren Wolk. One thing that blind readers will not be able to appreciate is the beautiful cover that my daughter described to me and that I hope you're going to describe to us.
It is so, so very, very different from the American cover that I was both shocked and thrilled. I love to see how different artists interpret things. It's mesmerizing. It's colorful. It's gorgeous. It's exciting. There's so much about it that intrigues. The U.S. cover is beautiful in its own way. It is a white background with glass jars filled with things that are symbolic in the book, like honeybees or herbs. There's a puppy on the cover. It's very simple and kind of muted. So in comparison to the UK cover, which is vibrant and really colorful, it's like night and day, fairly literally. One is fairly dark, one is fairly light. I love them both. It's really a treat to see what different publishers come up with.
And as we've already hinted, this isn't just a book that celebrates human beings and their interaction with nature. There is also a wonderful celebration of the animals that inhabit Echo Mountain, particularly the canine companions that a lot of the characters have.
I love dogs. I think they are so smart and loyal and wonderful. I just feel when I look into their eyes that they have so much to say. They're so smart and they find their ways into my books always. Actually, in Beyond the Bright Sea, there was a cat. So there's always an animal. And I don't imagine I could ever write a book that did not have one. I have two books that are coming out over the next few years that I wrote during the pandemic. One has an osprey in it, a beautiful fish hawk. We have many of them where I live. And the other has a dog. So I think my books are always going to have animal companions in them.
And the book really does celebrate resilience and in many ways offer young adults a roadmap to resilience. Don't blame, don't take things for granted, explore and make mistakes. And it really couldn't have come at a more apt time in the middle of a pandemic.
Oh, well, you know, it's funny because I do often hear that this is a good book for a pandemic. Obviously, I wrote it before I'd ever heard of COVID-19. And you're right. It's almost like I wrote it intentionally for this time we're living through, because it is about resilience in the face of adversity that affects really the whole world, the macrocosm whole world and the microcosm of our individual lives. But I believe that in every life and in every time, there are challenges that we can address by being personally responsible, by being engaged and involved, and by relying on our own resources as much as possible, instead of, as you say, passing the buck, placing blame, pointing fingers, and abdicating our responsibility. Think globally, act locally, be a strong individual, and I think we'll all be better off.
And be cautious, but don't live in fear?
I would say so. Caution is a good thing. Thinking, spending a little time thinking before we act is also a good idea. And I am often guilty of reacting very quickly. But as I get older, I spend more time sitting quietly and thinking, postponing action until I've thought things through and sleeping on it. I can't tell you how important that is. And I've learned that lesson fairly late in life, that if I have a huge problem, I think I have to address immediately. If I sleep on it, if I spend time thinking about it, I will usually come around to a better solution than my original reaction would have been.
And these are clearly messages that have chimed with the Silip Carnegie judges. You must be delighted to be shortlisted for a third time.
I am. I can't tell you what an honor it is. Any award, but this award in particular, I have a lot of Scottish blood in me. But also Andrew Carnegie is like Benjamin Franklin to me. The focus on literature, the focus on reading and writing, the focus on libraries. I don't know what my life would have been without libraries, which have always counted so importantly in my youth, especially, but ever since, and for my own children. Libraries are the key to our communities in so many ways. So I wish I could thank him in person. I can't, but this honor of being shortlisted for this award, it's very close to home for me, and I truly, truly appreciate being included again.
Well, Lauren Wolk, very many congratulations on being shortlisted again. And thank you for taking us into the world of Echo Mountain.
Thank you, Red. I truly appreciate everything.
Echo Mountain by Lauren Wolk is available from the RNIB Library. And Lauren will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Sarah Milano discusses her latest novel with Robert, and things get a little stranger with N.B. Dixon. But before all that, it's easy to think of reading as a solitary pursuit. But thousands of people, including many authors, enjoy being part of a book group. Lockdown has meant that face-to-face meetings have been impossible, but that hasn't stopped the conversations from happening, as RNIB Connect Radio's Ellie Marsh found out when she spoke to author Fiona Shaw.
Joining me today is Fiona Shaw, who is part of a brand new reading group with a twist and is here to tell us all about it. Fiona, thank you for joining me. So first of all, can you explain the format of Reading Round?
Yes, happily. So the reading round groups that we are looking to develop on Zoom, the format is that we will read the story. We'll have a short story and a poem to read each week. And the facilitator, which will be one of us writers, will read the story aloud. And then there'll be a discussion about it for anybody who'd like to take part in the discussion. And then we might have a short break, and then we'll do the same with a poem. So we'll read the poem aloud, and then people can just respond to it. The group can respond to it. So that's the format. And in my experience of running these groups, there's a kind of enormous pleasure for the group, because you in experiencing the story, the short story or the poem all together at the same time. And sometimes I found that a short story or a poem that I might not be completely sure what I think about, if you put eight people's thoughts together, it's amazing what you then come up with and how you then think, what you then think it's about. And often people might disagree with each other, that's fine, or interpret something in a different way, or sometimes a poem might give rise to kind of memories for somebody that evokes something for somebody that they bring to the group. So the discussions can happen in all kinds of different ways. And sometimes I'm running a group at the moment, and there's one person in the group who comes every week to listen, but you know, she doesn't want to particularly speak, but she really enjoys listening. So she comes each week and she listens, but she doesn't participate in the discussion. And that's also fine, because it means she has the opportunity to have the experience of with the group as well, of hearing this story being read aloud.
It's like a joint experience, isn't it? It's like it's reminding me almost of like a theatre performance or something like that, you know, and it's a communal experience and you're all experiencing it together and then being able to discuss it with the people that you've been with afterwards. And also with literature and with poetry, it's got so many different perspectives, and somebody mentions something, oh, I didn't think about it like that, and it completely like almost changes the way that you sort of read the poem in a way.
Absolutely. No, I've definitely found that. And I ran a group here in York for a few years with this format, a story and a poem each week. And at the beginning of it all, a lot of the group said they, most of them weren't particularly short story readers either. They like reading novels or nonfiction, but not usually short stories, but they'd all read longer fiction. But very few of them said they enjoyed reading poetry. And lots of them talked about, you know, if you come across a poem in a newspaper or something, you kind of read the first few lines and then flick over it, not quite knowing what to do with it or how to respond to it. So they were a bit apprehensive. But we very quickly found that hearing the poem aloud is different from reading it on your own in your head. And just coming to it as a group is so different. Nobody's got any expectations. It's not a teaching session. You're not being expected to know things. You're just being expected to hear it and see how you respond to it. So it's been a very rich experience for the group, and funny sometimes, very funny, with people interpreting different bits in a completely different way sometimes from each other. So yeah, it's been a really enjoyable thing to do.
Why do you think book groups and reading groups are such a popular thing that people enjoy doing?
I suppose it's an opportunity for a group of people to talk about something that's not themselves, but something that they have a really strong shared interest in or shared response to. And sometimes then, of course, bits of people's lives or personalities inevitably come in, and that can be quite interesting and funny as well. And so I think it's a way for a group to spend time together. It's not in a way that, you know, if you think about people, groups that form, who go walking together or make art together, I don't know, do knitting together. It's having something else that you're focused on, which also enables you to be part of a group and not just yourself. That can really give you some strong sense of community and shared belonging and, just those kinds of opportunities. It creates that kind of experience, I think, people. And a book group can do the same thing. The difference with this kind of book group as opposed to this kind of reading group rather than a book group that is the kind of book group that people more normally think about is that the group is reading the book together as well as in the same space in the same time, as well as having a conversation about it. And that's what makes these very particular and very special, I think.
And very accessible to blind and partially sighted people.
And very accessible to blind and partially sighted people. And indeed, I've had that experience as well within a group I ran in York, which was an in-person group in the days when we were able to meet in a room together, which I hope we'll be able to do again one day, where there were a couple of people in the group about 10 of us in the group, and two people were partially sighted. And they found the group, they just loved coming to the group because it gave them an opportunity to take part in a book group and a reading group that one of them particularly said that she found very difficult in a more ordinary context, because she couldn't necessarily get hold of an audio version of the book because the amount of time it took to listen to the book was different from the amount of time it took for the other participant to read the book and those kinds of things. And so in this kind of group, everybody in the group has the same experience of hearing the book, of hearing the story or hearing the poem. So it's a very level playing field in that way. And as long as somebody can get onto Zoom, you need to be able to access Zoom and have the Wi-Fi connectivity to be able to do that, then the group should be accessible to everybody.
And it's great that it's been able to carry on through lockdown, like you say, when we're not able to sort of meet each other in person, but you're still able to have that sort of community and connection just virtually instead.
Yes, in fact, form communities and connections, because I think that's one of the things that with this kind of group and with other kinds of groups, people have needed to be innovative and invent things and think outside our normal ways of meeting and being in a community. And actually, this provides us with an opportunity that we hadn't really noticed or looked at before. It also means that you can join a group that isn't necessarily in your local area, so you're not prevented from joining a group because there aren't, you know, seven other people in your area who also want to join one. These groups, you know, you might find you're in a group from your local area, but you might find you're in a group with people from all over the country. So that's also, you know, provides those kinds of opportunities mm-hmm. too.
Absolutely. So where can we find out more? How can we get involved?
So the best place to find out more at the moment is either is to send an email either to myself, my personal email, or to the Royal Literary Fund email, both of which I can give you. And then we can very happily get back in touch with you either by email or by phone and give you more information or have a chat through with people if they're interested and would like to potentially join one. So okay, my email is Fiona, F-I-O-N-A, at fiona-shaw.com. And the Royal Literary Fund email that you would for the national organisation of these groups is readinground, all one word, at rlf.org.uk.
Brilliant. Thank you, Fiona. Thank you for joining me here on R&IB Connect Radio.
Thanks to Ellie Marsh and Fiona Shaw. And a reminder that Fiona's email is Fiona@fiona-shaw.com, and Shaw is spelt S-H-A-W.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Talking Books has two shows per day, one at 8 a.m. and the other at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
My name is Jim Broadbent and I'm delighted to be reading for Talking Books.
Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library morning, afternoon or evening.
This is Julia Donaldson and you're listening to Talking Books.
And for younger listeners or the young at heart, Children's Talking Books is on every Saturday at 9, Sunday at 3 or Tuesday at 6 p.m. Books for all ages all through the day, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before N.B. Dixon leads us into the spooky world of The Little Stranger, here's Robert Kirkwood with a new release that's causing quite a stir.
Sarah Milano's young adult debut, This Can Never Not Be Real, is both a heartbreaking and a hopeful book. In the unremarkable town of Ambleside, the unthinkable has happened. Terrorists have attacked a local festival. No one knows why, and no one knows who the attackers are, but that doesn't matter. What matters first is survival, and what matters after that is survival too. The audio version is read by multiple narrators.
She picked my name from a children's book she was given when I was born, and it suits me too well sometimes. Shy Violet. I'm not one for dancing. I like the quieter edges, where I can watch without wondering who might be watching me. When Ellie dances, it's like she doesn't care if the whole world's looking on. And why should she? There's only her in the whole world when she dances. Just her.
Jo. She moves like she's, I don't know, less solid than the rest of us. Like she hasn't got bones weighing her down. It's the same quality that turns everyone's heads when she glides down the hall at school. I can never keep my eyes off her. No one can. And it's not just the whole model thing. Though, I can see how other girls stare at her like she's got a secret. Like if they could just figure out what it was, they might be able to copy it. They look at her like they'd like to climb into her skin and become her. That's how I was watching her then. That close. Couldn't help myself. Sam nudged me, hooking his finger under the ring pull of my can and laughing as he nicked it off me. Careful, or they'll pop out your head. I didn't even look at him. What? Your eyes, mate. He laughed again, but I knew he was watching too. We all were. She was just...
Violet. Beautiful. Peaches.
What a bitch.
This Can Never Not Be Real is a minute-by-minute account of a terror attack at a festival in a small town. It follows five teenagers who have nothing in common, but they'll need to depend on each other in order to survive the night, and it focuses very much on the survivors and not the terrorists.
So we don't really hear much about the terrorists in the book?
No, not at all, really. They're there, obviously, but as it's set very immersively in the experience, obviously the people that are going through it, they don't know who the terrorists are and what their motives are, so it's not part of their thought process. But also, I didn't want the book to focus on the terrorists because so much news coverage focuses on them. And really, there's never a good enough reason or a good enough motivation to carry out an act like this. So I didn't want the focus to be on terror. I wanted it to be on the survivors.
You say you had an unusual writing process for this book. What was that?
Yeah, it was a bit unusual for this book. So usually when I'm putting a book together, it takes quite a long time. It can take years just collecting little bits of ideas and putting the plot together. But for this one, I woke up in the middle of the night at about 2 a.m. and I grabbed my laptop, which I keep much too close to my bed, and just started writing. And I wrote about 3 pages and then went back to sleep. And usually when that happens, I'll have a look in the morning and it will be some random rambling nonsense like, do sharks like biscuits? Discuss. But in this case, it was a whole book. And I started writing based off that outline that morning and just kept going until I finished the whole book, which took about a month, which is very quick. And it honestly felt sometimes like if I left my computer, the book would carry on typing itself. It really felt like it wanted to be written.
Did you write it during lockdown?
No, gosh, I wrote it quite a long time ago. It takes a long time for books to get published.
Just that it was strange coming out of lockdown. It was strange reading about people being so closely packed together.
Yeah, I know. It was something that I thought about when I was editing the book, actually. I was thinking, oh, but no one goes to festivals, but hopefully they will be opening back up. And there is actually a little bit in the book where I put a nod to the fact that it was cancelled the year before, so we can theoretically place it maybe this autumn.
Violet. The whole of Amberside always comes out for the parade, especially this year.
Ellie. It was cancelled last year. The parade, the festival, everything. So this year felt like some kind of release. Like we were all taking one collective breath as we came together at the start of the route. The numbers were probably the same as they'd always been, but it felt more packed than ever. Everyone wanted to be closer than before. People pressed tight enough that it felt like we shared a single heartbeat between us. It was beautiful.
Now, it's quite a jump from hamsters and ghouls. Why was that?
Yeah, my first books were for younger readers and they're sort of romantic comedies that feature a comedy giant hamster. So it is quite a switch. And those books are under my nickname, Birdie Milano, whereas this book's under my name, Sarah Milano. It's because I want to write everything. And I don't only want to write serious books for older teenagers. I want to write fantasies and comedies and romances. And I just don't like being contained by one particular genre.
This book, especially compared to the other stuff you've written, doesn't shy away from things that could trigger people reading it.
Hard subjects. I mean, yes. It's set during a terror attack. It's inescapable that it's going to be a hard subject. I think the key to it is that it's not a book about terrorism. It's a book about survival. And I mean, we're all today incredibly aware of the shadow that terrorism has cast over our lives in the last few years. We see rolling news all the time. If an attack happens and they've been at concerts, in nightclubs, on trains, churches, even at a garlic festival. And that constant news exposure can feel really overwhelming to me at times. And it can be a lot to ask people to process. And so I kind of started thinking, all right, I find that following the stories of survivors when things like that happen helps me a lot to process it. And what about if we don't think about terror attacks in terms of who carried them out and the tally of the dead, but we think about the lives that were changed but will go on? Because I think there's a huge amount of hope and potential and possibility in that.
It's not based on any real event.
No, nothing specific. It's just kind of based on the world that we live in today. I would guess that my very, very first inspiration for it was way back in 2011, the attack on Utoya Island, which horrified me so much that I found that I had to follow the details about it. I read everything about it and I followed journalists that were live tweeting the trial. And the strength and the courage in some of the statements there just were amazing to me. And I didn't come out of that thinking, I'll write a book about it. I wasn't a writer at the time, but I think that probably stayed in the back of my head.
Now, the characters are all different shapes, different races, different sexualities. Was it a deliberate choice to make it so diverse?
I wouldn't say it was a choice, because especially with the way this book kind of wrote itself, they all just showed up and told me they were there. But yeah, I like the term inclusivity over diversity, because I just think, I never sit down and think, I want to include someone of this ethnicity or this sexuality, but I try to reflect the world that I live in, and that world is diverse, and it's just so much more interesting because of it. Obviously, you have to take some care when you're writing about characters whose experiences don't match your own, but it would be really boring if every character was just like me.
The characters in the book change almost line by line at times. How did you find their voices?
You know, it was fantastic because you could never get bored. If you got stuck on what one character was doing, you'd just jump across to the other character and let them tell their part of the tale. Something I'm really glad about with the audiobook is that we have different narrators for each character, which I think is relatively unusual in terms of audiobooks. It makes it almost like an audio drama, and it really helps to differentiate, obviously, each different voice, but it just brings it to life so well.
The voices involved are Olivia Forrest, Tommy Oldroyd, Daisy Prosper, Billy Ashcroft, Kane Fowler and Jasmine Lindsdale. Did you have any influence over who the narrators were?
I didn't have specific influence, but my publisher works with East 15 Drama School, and the cast of narrators are all from that drama school, which is, I think it's brilliant to be able to give them opportunities to be heard. I think it's an incredibly hard time for drama students right now. And they're just a fantastic cast. I did get to listen to the auditions and I had a little cry. Because I think when you've written the book and you're just listening to your own words, it's one thing, but hearing them brought to life by other people is really, really special. And it just got a bit emotion.
Did you not fancy doing one of the voices yourself?
I would love to, actually, but I wasn't sadly asked.
Ellie. Then, like always, we headed up the road to Herne House.
Peaches. Historic Herne House, as they put it on the posters. We call it something simpler.
Violet. The house on the hill.
Ellie. Everyone's either in the parade or watching it. Students from Clifton Academy and Sefton College, even the ones who'd say they're too old. Parents pretending they're supervising. Little kids hanging off people's arms, asking for a turn with a torch. I remember wondering what we must have looked like from above. All these pinpricks of light on the move, like shooting stars reflected in a dark, winding lake. Little comets.
This Can Never Not Be Real by Sarah Milano is out now wherever you buy your books or audiobooks. And Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Sarah Milano and Robert Kirkwood. Now, before we return to Lauren Wolk to share the books of her life, as regular listeners to RNIB Connect Radio will know, our ethos is in our name. It's about connecting our community and ensuring that the voices of blind and visually impaired people are heard. We love to receive your emails and feedback and, here at Read On, your book reviews. Novelist N.B. Dixon is the author of the Outlaw's Legacy series, an alternative history of Robin Hood. It's a rollercoaster ride packed full of family feuds, betrayals, romance, and one man's fight for his beliefs. She's also a voracious reader and a regular contributor to the show. Her latest book review is of a novel that's hit the big screen.
Hello, this is NB Dixon with my review of The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters. I've heard of this author, but I must admit this is the first book of hers I checked out, and I was intrigued when I heard a trailer for the film that's based on the book. That was what drew me to it.
The first time I saw Hundreds Hall was July 1919. Nothing could have prepared me for the spell it cast. When I saw the house again 30 years later, I could hardly comprehend the change in the place.
Why don't you tell me what's going on?
You wouldn't believe me.
Mother, this is Dr. Faraday.
How did you find the patient?
A little under the weather. It's war shock.
They brought Caroline home to nurse him.
I'd heard they were troubled. Very hush-hush about it.
A long time ago. Who's the child here?
What are you doing here?
Susan died before I was born.
There's something evil in this house.
That's nonsense.
Betty, what are you doing here?
You rang for me, miss.
I did not.
Well, Mrs. Ayres was upstairs.
Rang itself. Did it? What is all the noise?
I thought it was really gripping. I know I often say that in my reviews, but it's just as true with this book. The reader really does draw you in, sort of from the start, and it's very atmospheric. You instantly get transported back to the past and to a creepy house where a family are living and where you know there's something not quite right. So you've got the mystery element, you've got the slight creepy feeling that intensifies as the book goes on. The Little Stranger is about a local parish doctor who is sent out to an old country house to tend to a serving maid, and he becomes acquainted with the family, and as he gets to know them, there seems to be a darkness that's surrounding them, and it gradually seems to be sucking them into it one by one. And he tries very hard to ignore what's going on, but meanwhile, the crisis or curse is escalating.
I first saw Hundreds Hall when I was 10 years old. It was the summer after the war, and the Ayreses still had most of their money then, were still big people in the district. The event was an Empire Day fete. I stood with a line of other village children making a Boy Scout salute, while Mrs. Ayres and the Colonel went past us, handing out commemorative medals. Afterwards we sat to tea with our parents at long tables on what I suppose was the South Lawn. Mrs. Ayres would have been 24 or 5, her husband a few years older. Their little girl Susan would have been about 6. They must have made a very handsome family, but my memory of them is vague. I recall most vividly the house itself, which struck me as an absolute mansion.
It's a great book. It deals with psychology. It deals with the strength of your beliefs, what one person is prepared to accept. It deals with the unexplained. And I think it's really cleverly handled. I couldn't stop reading it, even when it got very, very spooky. And I made the mistake of reading it at night. I still couldn't stop. So it's billed as horror, and I have to say I don't generally read horror fiction. I wouldn't go so far as to give it that name, but I remember reading another review where somebody described it as chilling, and I think that does apply. But so it's probably not for everybody, but I absolutely loved it. It's narrated by Simon Vance. I'm not usually a fan of his, but I have to say I thought he handled this particular book brilliantly. It is available in the RNIB library, so I would say download the book and read it. It's fantastic. And it has stayed with me So that's always a sign of a good read.
So when I did see the house again, almost 30 years on from that first visit and shortly after the end of another war, the changes in it appalled me. It was the purest chance that took me out there, for the Ayreses were registered with my partner, David Graham, but he was busy with an emergency case that day, so when the family sent for a doctor, the request was passed on to me. My heart began to sink almost the moment I let myself into the park. I remembered a long approach to the house, through neat rhododendron and laurel. But the park was now so overgrown and untended, my small car had to fight its way down the drive. When I broke free of the bushes at last and found myself on a sweep of lumpy gravel, with the hall directly ahead of me, I put on the brake and gaped in dismay. The house was smaller than in memory, of course, not quite the mansion I'd been recalling, but I'd been expecting that. What horrified me were the signs of decay. Sections of the lovely weathered edgings seemed to have fallen completely away, so that the house's uncertain Georgian outline was even more tentative than before. Ivy had spread, then patchily died, and hung like tangled rat's tail hair. The steps leading up to the broad front door were cracked, with weeds growing lushly up through the seams.
Thanks, as ever, to N.B. Dixon. The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters is available in Braille and as TB16895. Now it's back to Lauren Wolk for the books of her life.
Lauren, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, yes. My parents always read to me every night when I was little, and we would read the same books over and over and over again, so they're imprinted in my DNA and they're nestled in my bones. But there was one in particular called Goodnight Moon by Margaret Wise Brown, illustrated by Clement Hurd. That book, and I know it's a favorite for many, really taught me, whether I was aware of the lessons at the time or not, about the power of language to draw readers in to a setting, to a family, to a place. The great green room of that book is a place I have inhabited over and over and over again in my life, both, well, I was going to say literally and figuratively, and really, I guess I mean that. I am in that room when I think of that book. And the mood of that book and the way the author used language taught me about the right words in the right order. So that book always stands for me as an example of what inspired me to be a writer myself.
Unfortunately, there isn't an audiobook version of Goodnight Moon by Margaret Wise Brown, but here's a clip of Susan Sarandon narrating the book on YouTube.
In the great green room, there was a telephone, and a red balloon, and a picture of the cow jumping over the moon. And there were three little bears sitting on chairs, and two little kittens, and a pair of mittens.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Again, many, and I do reread books a lot. It's like listening to songs over and over again. But one, a rainy day book from my childhood that also had a huge impact on me would be Charlotte's Web by E.B. White. I'm really going back to my childhood. Charlotte's Web, I read when I was sick in bed. It wasn't raining, but it was like a rainy day. And it spoke to me on every emotional level there is. And my mother talks about how she heard me weeping and she ran to see what was wrong and she found that I had finished the book. It broke my heart and healed it again. And so that book I would return to over and over again as one that just wakes up all my emotions and leaves me feeling completely alive.
Wilbur liked Charlotte better and better each day. Her campaign against insects seemed sensible and useful. Hardly anybody around the farm had a good word to say for a fly. Flies spent their time pestering others. The cows hated them. The horses detested them. The sheep loathed them. Mr. and Mrs. Zuckerman were always complaining about them and putting up screens. Wilbur admired the way Charlotte managed. He was particularly glad that she always put her victim to sleep before eating it.
"It's real thoughtful of you to do that, Charlotte," he said.
"Yes," she replied in her sweet musical voice. "I always give them an anesthetic so they won't feel pain. It's a little service I throw in."
Liza Ross narrating Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, it's called All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Like many books about World War II, it's incredibly dark. But the characters, the story, the settings all are so strong that I find myself thinking of that book all the time as I go through my days. It ripped my heart out and it made me so sad for us as a species. But there is also hope in the book and resilience and strong relationships. More than anything, though, it's the writing. The writing has always got, for me, no matter what else is true about a book, the writing has to be great for it to really grab me and stay with me.
Verna is 8 years old and ferreting about in the refuse behind a storage shed when he discovers what looks like a large spool of thread. It consists of a wire-wrapped cylinder sandwiched between two discs of pine wood. Three frayed electrical leads sprout from the top. One has a small earphone dangling from its end. Yuta, 6 years old, with a round face and a mashed cumulus of white hair, crouches beside her brother. "What is that?" "I think," Verna says, feeling as though some cupboard in the sky has just opened. "We just found a radio."
Julie Teal narrating All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Lauren Walk, thank you so much for sharing your joy of reading with the listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you for having me, Red. I hope to get to meet you in the flesh someday.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.